This is Hacker Public Radio episode 3243 for Wednesday the 6th of January 2021. Today's show is entitled, PICTA, Free and Open Radio Astronomy. It is hosted by Andrew Conway, and is about 48 minutes long, and carries a clean flag. The summary is, discussion with the people that created the PICTA radio telescope.
This episode of HPR is brought to you by archive.org. Support universal access to all knowledge by heading over to archive.org/donate.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Hacker Public Radio with me, McNallu, also known as Andrew. And I'm sort of on my home turf talking about astronomy today. But I'm not the one that's going to be saying the interesting things, not that I maybe ever do. I'm actually joined by two guests who run a very interesting and novel radio telescope projects. So would you like to introduce yourselves to our listeners?
Sure. So my name is Apostolos. I am studying computer science at the University of Piraeus in Greece. Me and Vasilis actually work on several RF and radio astronomy projects. One of them is the PICTA radio telescope, which we will discuss mostly today. I hope the listeners enjoy our conversation, our chat.
So my name is Vasilis. I'm Apostolos' brother. I'm a graduate student of European and International Studies in University of Piraeus, and now I'm a postgraduate student in Technical University of Athens in Environment and Development. As Apostolos told you, we are running PICTA, and I hope you have a great podcast.
Great. Thank you very much, guys. So we should say how we met, in that we were both at FOSDEM earlier this year. You just came up to the HPR table, somehow were introduced to me, and you told me about your PICTA telescope, and that's how we got to this episode. So before we go any further, can you just explain to people who maybe are not that familiar with astronomy or even radio telescopes what what a radio telescope does?
Yeah, sure. So a radio telescope is basically like an optical telescope, but it's actually, instead of observing in visible wavelengths, it's actually built for detecting radio signals. So one thing many people are not aware of is that objects in space do not only emit visible wavelengths, but there are many objects that emit radio waves. So like neutral hydrogen, for example, several atomic and molecular spectral lines, masers, pulsars, radio galaxies, quasars. I mean, there's a whole variety of objects that emit radio waves. And so a radio telescope is basically an instrument used to detect such objects. So it's basically opening up a window to the invisible universe in a way.
Yeah, that's a great little description. You mentioned masers there. That's actually something that I worked on, and it really surprising if people don't know. Masers is like a naturally occurring microwave version of a laser, but we get them in our own star, the sun. I haven't heard that word for a while. Really interesting.
yeah, it's interesting.
Yeah. So now, your telescope, the PICTA radio telescope, it's special because, as I understand it, it's open source. So could you say how it came about and how you decided to make it an open source project, both in software and hardware, I understand?
We wanted to build a radio telescope at the beginning, like for personal use. But then we decided, you know, why not? We've built the telescope. We've invested a lot of time into it, both in terms of hardware and software. So why not put it online for everyone to use it for free? So one part of this, because it's basically in the same philosophy, is to put it up open source. Now, every project we work on in radio astronomy is like everything we do is open source. On so you can find everything on GitHub. And the good thing about this is that that many people have actually came to the project, copied the source code, and worked on their own projects. Some of them either use it for digital signal processing, for data analysis, and some just even applied the whole code to their telescopes. So that's pretty good. That's pretty cool. So and also we have the contributors. So you check our GitHub, you'll see some pull requests and contributions. So it's definitely like a win-win situation in a way.
At every point, an open source standard, the information can spread around to people very easily and can definitely help you back at some point. So that's why we release everything at GitHub.
Excellent. And so, and what language are you coding in?
So we mainly use Python. So Picture is basically based on Python. For the for the web server, we use PHP. So a user sends a request. It gets passed to like via PHP to a page that the Raspberry Pi computer on the telescope can access via Python, and basically fetch the observation parameter. So it just runs the observation from there and sends the data to the user via email. And it doesn't just send the raw data, because that wouldn't be super convenient for the user, you know. Basically, the user has to do no work. Basically, it just fills in the form, sends the data, sends the parameters of the observation, and receives an email with an image file. So that image file basically contains all the plots, all the data.
And can anyone use it?
Yeah. That's why we decided to create an online remote radio telescope which everyone could use totally for free, no matter where they live, their educational background. That was the main reason we decided to create an instrument such as Picture. And actually, another reason was that radio astronomy, particularly in Greece, is not very popular, at least compared to optical astronomy. And to be honest, this does make sense to a certain point, because astronomy at visible wavelengths works pretty much like our eyes do. You have a lens, you have an optical sensor, so it's very easy to understand what you're observing and how everything works. And on the other hand, radio astronomy is a different thing, because human does not have a radio sensor to detect a radio signal. So it's difficult for someone to understand how everything works at a very first start point.
Right. Okay. I mean, that sounds good. So anyone can use it. Are you looking for contributors to the project in terms of like developing the code or anything like that?
Yeah, sure. I mean, everything is open. So if anyone wants to contribute, make a pull request, of course, absolutely, we are actively looking for people who wish to help. You don't have to contribute to use Picture, obviously. But, you know, if you've got programming knowledge or have some ideas you wish to implement, which has already been done, like certain people have come on GitHub, said, okay, Picture is cool, but I want to improve it. So here's a code snippet you could apply to, for example, send me some of the data in a raw format so I can do further analysis or whatever. And yeah, pretty much you can contribute. You don't have to, of course, but any contribution is, of course, appreciated.
Yeah, great. So, I mean, you do have an audience right now of people who are certainly have the skills to contribute, people who are interested in free and open source software, people I know that are interested in, you mentioned Python, you also mentioned Raspberry Pis. That's another topic that comes up quite a lot in Hacker Public Radio. So, yeah, so folk listening, you know, you might want to take a look and see if there's something you can offer here. So anyone can use it. And I've been looking at your website. Your website is actually very clean, nice introduction. It's not, if you're maybe even somebody at school, it's not going to scare you off, I don't think. It's nice, gentle introduction to the world of radio astronomy. And you've got a PDF that you can download that introduces you as well, which I thought was really nice. I've not read the whole thing yet, but the beginning of it looks really good. So do you have any hopes of particular people who would be using it? Are you wanting schools to use it, or you just want general people of interest to start using it, maybe developing their own projects? Any thoughts on that front?
Yeah, I think first of all, thank you for your kind words. At the beginning, it was mostly friends and people around the world who just wanted to use a radio telescope. But now we have a lot of proposals from some schools or even universities who want to use Pictor as an educational project. And that makes us really happy because we have the feeling that we can contribute at some point to radio astronomy education, and that's really awesome.
It is indeed, yeah. So I mean I can think of quite a few groups that I would know that would be interested in using it, because one problem we have with astronomy, and I'm here in Scotland, and like the whole of the UK, really, our weather is not great. In fact, I've got about the worst weather in the country. So we only get, maybe 30, 40, 50 nights a year where it's clear, so we can use normal telescopes, optical telescopes. So actually, we've got the ideal climate for radio astronomy, because radio astronomy, it's not bothered about clouds, is it? You can see straight through clouds.
Yeah, exactly. That's a very, very big advantage of radio astronomy comparing to optical astronomy. And but even here, actually, optical astronomy, of course, it's something very, very popular. We also working on optical astronomy as well. But in some northern countries like Scotland or Belgium, for example, things are much more difficult for optical astronomy, because it's like 90% of the year cloudy. So yeah, radio astronomy is the only way there.
Yes, I know. It's I confess I've worked in the theoretical side of things, like I mentioned masers, but I've never actually worked I actually used a radio telescope before, but I've got a feeling that's about to change once I get to know your telescope a little bit. So now I imagine that you've put a lot of work into this from the looks of it. Were there any particular challenges along the way that you had to deal with, that you found difficult to deal with?
It's definitely been a lot of work, like from the very beginning until even before and after everything works, you're still making improvements. So it's definitely quite challenging. But, as I said, users don't have to worry about this. The code is ready, and they can apply it to their telescopes and everything. So some of the challenges, I remember one time, at the early beginning, we had obtained this dish seemingly for 2.4 gigahertz. I mean, at least that's what the manufacturer claimed it to work at. And basically, it didn't work. We had built the feed horn. We had measured everything. We had pretty much tried everything. And the problem was that this dish had actually got, it was like a grid sort of dish, like with holes. And so the wavelength, the 21 centimeter wavelength, was basically too short for these holes. So what we ended up doing is, I remember being out one morning and I just said, okay, why not? Let me just try to turn the feed horn around to point directly to the zenith. And it actually worked like magic. I see the hydrogen line barely, but so what we ended up doing is to test if this was a problem with the dish, just take all the aluminum foil from the kitchen, just wrap it around the dish along the reflector. So that ended up being the solution. Obviously, we cannot have a piece of aluminum foil running 24/7 in the rain and things like that. So we just took like a mesh and cut it around the dish. So that's basically a sort of more permanent solution.
Okay, we do have a lot of funny stories about picture issues. For example, in Fosdem, there is a very, very interesting story. We've made a lot of talks in Greece, all over Greece, and no problem ever happened. Everything worked very well. And I'm talking about problems because Pictor, as we said, it's a remote radio telescope. And of course, when we have a talk, we make a presentation about how Pictor works. And of course, we are doing an online observation, a remote observation. And in Greece, everything worked like a charm. Everything went perfect. But when we were in Fosdem, lots of miles away from Pictor control, just before the our presentations, we realized that we have a problem connecting to the telescope, because of course we always do a test observation before a talk to be sure that everything works perfectly. And we had a problem. We had no connection with the telescope, and we didn't know what to do. Fortunately, we tried to contact at home Greece and tell to someone to just restart the control panel of the picture, because something went weird with the voltage. And at the very, very last the minute, we solved the problem, and everything went fine.
Oh, that's well, I'm glad to hear it. And it's a shame I missed the talk at Fosdem, because I was one day I was stuck to the HPR table, and the other day I was overwhelmed with talks I wanted to go to. but yeah, that's really, you mentioned in the. Well, part of the reason I asked that question is because I really want people to realize that when you go into the website, imagine it looks fairly, I mean, it does look fairly easy and straightforward, but it's good to appreciate how much work goes behind these things. It's not just a few buttons on a web page and there's a little aerial stuck out a window somewhere. This is quite a bit more work, quite a bit more serious work than that. And I think that's the point I really want folk to understand. Now, you mentioned the 21 centimeter line. Now, for listeners that don't know, that is the wavelength that neutral, normal hydrogen emits at. Yeah. And that is the line that we map out our galaxy at. That's how we know we are in a spiral galaxy, and that's how it was first measured. So you can actually examine our own galaxy at that 21 centimeter line.
Yeah, exactly. For our listeners who are not familiar with radio astronomy, basically neutral hydrogen atoms tend to emit radio waves under specific conditions. We won't get into the quantum physics, how this works, but for those interested, it's called the spin flip 21 centimeter transition. So basically, these atoms of hydrogen emit radio waves. They emit radio waves at a very specific wavelength, at 1420.405 megahertz. And so, you know, our galaxy is, of course, very rich in hydrogen. So when you point a radio telescope to the galactic plane, you will almost certainly pick up, not almost, you will certainly pick up some signal at 1420 megahertz. And based on the Doppler shift, that is how fast the object is moving relative to you, whether it's approaching you or traveling away from you, you will get a bit of a shift in the frequency. So in the frequency domain on in the spectrum. So from these, like if you take many, many measurements of the sky, you end up with plenty of Doppler shift measurements. So to put it quite simply, you can actually map the Milky Way from with a radio telescope and even map out the like plot the rotation curve of the galaxy, which is basically evidence for the existence of black matter.
And that's the interesting with hydrogen line observations, because with in optical astronomy, of course, you can see the Milky Way, but you cannot see behind the Milky Way, and you can understand how a spiral galaxy can be, at least without seeing other galaxies. But yes, in radio astronomy, you can see it thanks to Doppler shift. The peaks from other galaxy arms, and do a map on that.
Yeah, it's like looking at a frisbee from the side.
yeah, that's very very clearly explained. So, let's say for a project, or maybe there's a skeptic out there who doesn't believe the shape of our galaxy is a spiral and it's rotating in the way they say. They don't believe in dark matter, you know. Could they use your telescope to do measurements and test and produce results that would show this Doppler shift?
Yeah, absolutely. If you observe, even right now probably, you might see more than one peak. You might see, for example, two or three distinct peaks. So the Doppler shift, like, because, okay, you see one peak and then one to the right and then another one to the right maybe. This is because the different spiral arms in the galaxy move at a different velocity relative to the sun or the earth. So an observer can use picture telescope to observe this Doppler shift, and yeah, it's pretty much evidence, like beyond any doubt, that we do indeed live in a spiral galaxy.
Yes, and the dark matter you mentioned, that came about because there's a galaxy we can see. And if we just look at that and then apply Newton's laws, then we would expect the galaxy to rotate in a certain way, but it doesn't. When we looked at the 21 centimeter line, we found that it rotates in a different way, at different speeds as you go out from the center of the galaxy. And that is the dark matter, which you see we can actually look for that with your telescope. That's excellent.
Essentially, yeah, for the dark matter, for people who are not familiar with, okay, you have a dish, how can this prove a dark matter? Basically, you take some measurements of the sky, and given the Doppler shifts, you end up combining the data basically produce a rotation curve. So what a rotation curve is basically the velocity of the objects orbiting a certain body. So for example, in the solar system, planets move in a certain motion. And this follows Kepler's third law of motion, but when you try to apply this to galaxies, you get a completely different shape. And so the main theory basically behind this disagreement in the expected with the measured rotation curve, because this is actually seen in pretty much every galaxy, not only the Milky Way. This is basically evidence that there has to be more mass in our galaxy. And so that's the hypothesis or the theory that dark matter is really there.
Yeah. Yeah. And so what else could you be observing? Is there anything, for example, that we could observe in our solar system with PicTor?
Yeah, so you can theoretically detect the sun. It's a very bright radio source in the sky. Now, PicTor is mostly intended for hydrogen line work. So, you know, we could, of course, turn it to do solar drift scans. But you know, obviously, this would be, because we have such a huge user base, it would be a bit difficult to see to sort of coordinate. Like, okay, does everyone want to see the sun? Because I think detecting hydrogen clouds is a bit more interesting for people from what we've seen. So that's the main intended source, basically galactic hydrogen, like the hydrogen line, basically.
Well, most users who try to build their first telescope, they of course will do tests with the sun or the moon. And actually, when we started hosting Pictor, we realized that sun and moon, or even Jupiter, are quite popular at observing that, and hydrogen line was a little bit difficult than all the others. So that's why we focus on hydrogen line.
Okay, yeah, no, that makes perfect sense. I think that's an excellent way to draw people in to the subject, actually. So, you know, going back to the sort of more technical aspects, are there any things that, are there any developments or improvements that you're working on, or is everything just in a sort of stable state and you're maintaining it that way just now?
Yeah. So, okay. So both of the web interface as well as the processing software is constantly getting improved. Like even yesterday, last night, I was doing improvements on the software. So. Yeah, there's tons of improvements on tons of updates, tons of GitHub commits you will see. And this is mostly on the software. So it allows the user to do more specific data analysis. So, for example, if there's radio frequency interference, which is a big problem in radio astronomy, you can sort of the software helps you sort of cut it out a bit, mitigate the RFI. So yeah, there's definitely lots of updates and improvements almost every day, really.
I think the most difficult part on setting a remote radio telescope is itself the remote thing. As you find out how this works, all the other stuff, it's not that difficult. I mean, of course, we are going to do improvements and even on the hardware, but the remote stuff, it's the most difficult thing, because as we told you, in some situations you cannot have control, even if the software about the RF are working great. If there are issues with the remote stuff, then everything can go like a mess. So we always trying to see if there are still improvements on the remote stuff, and then came everything else.
Yeah, I imagine that's actually quite. Yeah, I can see that's why that's the most difficult part to automate a telescope, is. It's quite hard because there's lots of little details that you have to contend with. You mentioned interference. What sources of interference have you had to contend with?
Yeah. So there's basically two types of radio frequency interference. One is spurious sort of interference, and the other is unintended, and the other is intended interference. So what this means is that, for example, your cell phone, when you're in a call, emits some radio waves to communicate with the cell tower. And of course, this can contaminate your signal. What we actually had to deal with, and this is another interesting story, is unwanted emissions. So for example, a Raspberry Pi may emit radiation due to the electronic circuits. So this is completely unwanted and unintentional, but unfortunately it happens. So I remember, for example, when because the first time I just tested with my laptop and saw the hydrogen line, but then, you know, we wanted to automate everything, make it available online, things like that. And so we placed the Raspberry Pi near the disk, and just all of a sudden, like, so much noise and interference popped up. So the simple solution is just build a Faraday cage, which is basically a metal box which basically shields you from radiation, from interference. So you know, the Raspberry Pi is in a metal box, so it can't really contaminate the telescope.
Actually, interference is a very, very harmful story in RF. We had so much weird stuff going on the spectrum. For example, I remember a time when we had some tests, and Apostolos telling me for a couple of hours that we have a very, very, very weird interference, and it was very, very difficult to understand what was that. And at the end of it, we realized that it was a computer. It was the power source of a computer, a power adapter, and it was making interference. And it's something that you cannot imagine at the very first stage.
Yes, I know. There's a story here in, well, not here, but in Wales, which is, if you don't know, next to England, for listeners who are not familiar. In this little village, they had their broadband installed some years ago, and every morning at 7 a.m., the broadband in the village would go down. It would just stop working. And nobody knew why. It worked perfectly overnight and in the most late in the evenings, but at 7 a.m. it would always go down. And it turned out that one villager had this old-fashioned cathode ray tube television from the 1970s, and he turned it on to watch the news at 7 a.m. on the dot every day. And that created so much radio interference that it destroyed the microwave transmitter to the village.
Oh, really? Yeah, it's actually funny. Yeah.
Yeah. So, but for radio telescopes, this is serious stuff because you're doing, well, yeah, it could ruin your, could ruin all your observations if somebody sort of switched on a television like that, or, you know, like a power pack, like you said, of a computer. So you mentioned that you've got software that can, so you mentioned Faraday cage, which is a hardware solution, but you also said that you've got software solutions to removing interference and noise on the signal.
Yeah, absolutely. So generally with radio frequency interference, you try to mitigate as much as possible. One segment of that is hardware, as you mentioned, but there's also software solutions. They don't always work, of course, but they can definitely help. One, like, to get into the mathematics a little bit, one way we remove narrowband radio frequency interference at Victor is with a median operation. So you apply a median to the spectra, and suddenly the peaks just disappear. So that's, for example, one way you can get rid of radio frequency interference, and that's also good for Victor because it's not a supervised method of removing interference. So I don't have to be on my computer waiting for every single observation to analyze. That would be pretty difficult. but for manual, like if you have more annoying sort of interference that it's contaminating your data, it gets your data very contaminated, then you can do some manual or supervised processing and data analysis to get rid of the interference in software. So you can do this by, for example, in a NumPy array, for people familiar with Python, you can just blank the channels, and the interference basically disappears like that. It's not always very easy because, you know, sometimes the interference is really, really close to your signal, like the hydrogen line, for example, but it can definitely help.
Okay, yeah, I can imagine there's a lot of interference to contend with. So I haven't actually submitted a request to do an observation yet. I should have done. I keep looking at the page and then thinking, oh no, maybe I should read the instructions. I'll confess, I'm from an old school of read the manual first. So I want to go and read the manual. Luckily, your manual's easy to read. So, but I haven't yet used it, but I'm definitely going to. So I'm looking at the page right now, and it's a few fields.
Right.
Yeah.
Don't worry, we'll get you through. It generally takes 1 minute to submit an observation. Not much thinking.
One thing we want to mention is that there is actually no request. It's just a submit. When someone wants to make an observation, there is no request for us to say okay and stuff like that. It does a submission, and the telescope automatically does the observation for you.
All right. So when if I typed in a request, then you're not sitting there going, "Oh no, it's Andrew in Scotland making a stupid observation request
yeah,
again."
Yeah.
He's gonna break the telescope. Ban him. You know that doesn't happen. you make sure that I can't do anything stupid.
Okay.
Yeah, don't worry. There's no way to break it.
That's okay. Why I told you the most of stuff is to get secure with the remote, with everything that has to do with the remote, to avoid any problems due to, for example, wrong controls and stuff like that. So yeah, there are no requesting, only submissions.
Okay, right. Okay, that gives me a lot more confidence to go in. And, I was going to say try and break it, but I would try. I'm sure I would fail if I did try. So I noticed when it says, would you like to receive your raw data as a CSV file? Yes or no? Could you describe briefly what we do get back? What information we would get back after submitting a request?
Yeah. So whether you select yes or no on this field, you get a plot file. Usually, for most users, including you, a plot file, an image file is sufficient. So you can just say no there. But if you wanted to get the raw data, so get like because you usually just get an image file. If you want the raw data to sort of play around a bit, then you can, of course, select yes. So it's up to you. Either way, you will get the data you need. So you can select no now, anything you want.
For the users that visit the Pictor Telescope for the first time, we suggest to use the no option because the raw data can confuse them. So I think it's easier to play on with a no option.
Okay. Well, while you were talking, I submitted my first request. So I hope that wasn't too spammy of me, but I thought I would, since it was so easy, I thought I would give it a go.
Yeah, sure.
And I really have to say to people, don't be scared off by this. I mean, literally, there's a few fields, you can take the default values to, you know, it's extremely friendly. It's not scary at all. I would have no problem sitting my 9-year-old daughter in front of it, you know, and, you know, in a matter of minutes, I could explain to her what she should do. Explaining to her what the results mean, well, I'm not so sure I could do that quite so quickly. But it looks very straightforward, I have to say. A great way into radio astronomy. So
you submitted the observation, I don't know, was it like 10 seconds, 20? You should receive it as soon as it finished.
It was 10 seconds, yeah. It was the shortest option. Yeah.
Okay, yeah, you should receive the observation if you check your emails, probably.
Yeah, there it is. Wow, I've got a nice little PNG file with spectrum, radio velocity, so... Is that me? Is this radio velocity curve that I see in my email? That is of our galaxy.
Yeah. This little peak that you're seeing is actually the Milky Way. It's a spiral. It corresponds to a spiral arm in our galaxy. And you can see the radial velocity above. I've put a secondary axis there, so it automatically, you see exactly at what velocity the hydrogen clouds are moving at relative to you. If you observe at some other time, you will see a different different sort of Doppler shift because you're obviously pointing to a different location in the galactic plane. So you're sort of exposed to different spiral arms. But yes, sometimes you even see two or three peaks there. So it's definitely an interesting thing to try.
Yeah, well, I've got three peaks actually. So I presume that maybe looking through three different hydrogen clouds, perhaps in different spiral arms of the galaxy.
Are you looking at the left plot or the top center?
I'm looking at the left one. Yeah, sorry, is that the wrong one to look at? That's the signal to noise ratio. Sorry. Yeah.
So the left one is basically the raw spectrum. And this is where digital signal processing and the software comes into play because. This is the raw data. This is what the SDR receives. It's not what the actual sky looks like, because you know these three humps, the big ones, the wide ones, are actually are caused by the SDR basically. So what we do is, okay, we point to the sky when the Milky Way is not at the zenith, so at the horizon, so we don't get any contamination, and we calibrate the telescope. So we say, okay, this is what the sky looks like without hydrogen. And then we basically subtract or divide the spectra. So it's basically the raw data divided by the calibration data. So if you look at the top center, it becomes more flat. So basically the sort of SDR artifacts basically cancel out. And what you end up with is this hydrogen peak. It should be at 1420.5 megahertz.
Yes,
around there. Yeah, and this is basically the hydrogen. This is the true sky signal.
Okay.
And something you might see on the right, a very narrow one. This is probably radio frequency interference. Notice I mentioned the median earlier, the median operation. This is the red curve that you're seeing. So if you look on the right where this narrow peak exists, which does contaminate the data, of course, but applying median operation, basically, if you look at the red curve alone, there's no interference at all. So that's basically the logic behind median operations. And it's applied automatically. You don't have to worry about what factor I will use on the observation form, nothing like that.
What we want to make clear is that for a beginner observer, the window that she should concentrate is the center one, the calibrated spectrum. There is the easiest way to see the hydrogen line, the power versus time, the waterfall, or the average spectrum. Are things that not so important on all that. I mean, are some data for users who want to know more about how all this stuff is working on and how we calibrate the data. But the main part is the calibrated spectrum.
Yes, I see that. Yeah, I was indeed looking at the wrong one. So so I do see one peak, and I see that at 1420 megahertz, and then a much larger spiky one at slightly higher frequency. That is excellent. So from the listeners, I'll put this image that I'm looking that we're discussing now in the show notes, so you can actually see what's being discussed. And of course, you can run your own observations, but they'll be different. But I will put this specific observation that I just got. One other question: the bottom time series graph of relative power, it shows a decreasing trend over the 10 seconds of observation. Why is it decreasing? Do you know?
Yeah, that's a good question. That's a good observation of you, because it's actually not that clear compared to other observations. But it's not a sky effect. It's completely an SDR thing. So if you get, for example, a different SDR, it might be more flat from the beginning. It has to do with we're getting into more technical stuff here, but it has to do with sort of the temperature variation as soon as the observation begins. If you observe for like 10 hours, of course, you won't see a constant decrease in power. After like 30 minutes or so, it will start to flatten out. So it's completely an SDR effect.
Okay. And you mentioned the SDR before. What does SDR stand for?
SDR is software-defined radio. So it's basically a spectrometer, like a device that you feed your RF signal in, like you do with, for example, a TV decoder. So an SDR is basically a very, very versatile and moddable sort of device that you plug into your computer. It's literally a USB stick, usually, most of the times. And with the GNU Radio, which is an open source framework for radio work, you can sort of program what you want your SDR to do. Like, you acquire some data, and then you pass the data, the raw data, to a digital signal processing pipeline. So this is basically what an SDR does. It's basically a receiver that lets you do pretty much anything.
Right. Okay. Yeah, I'd never come across that before. Yeah. So that's obviously because my training in radio astronomy was theoretical and before USB was invented. So that's why I've not heard of it. I'm too old. Okay. That's all great. So, I think we're sort of getting towards the end of the episode. Is there anything else that you'd like to mention that we've not managed to cover so far?
I don't know if we mentioned this. We did send you we mentioned it in the email, but for people who want to see, you have this telescope with over 3,000 observations on the archive from over 700 users from all around the world. One thing we actually managed to do quite recently is obtain the very first radio image in Greece. We obviously mentioned how radio astronomy is not that popular in Greece, but we're happy to basically help with a little bit of contribution. So what we've done is to basically advance radio astronomy in Greece. What we've done is we picked our telescope. We've actually obtained the very first radio image of the sky. So it's a Northern Sky Hydrogen Line survey that listeners can find on the GitHub as well.
Okay, yes. And so that's you did send me that email. I forgot to mention it. That was right at the beginning. And I'll put that image, your first image from Greece, I'll make sure that goes in the show notes too for our listeners to look at. Excellent. So I said one last question. How did you choose the name Pictor? Where did that come from?
So on the southern sky, there's a radio galaxy called Pictor A. So that's basically where it originated from.
Right. Okay. I didn't make the connection there, but yeah. Okay. I have vaguely heard of that.
Yeah, galaxy. It's not a very popular galaxy, but yeah.
Actually, we wanted to have a unique name because the most astronomy project have very very similar names like constellations or something like Cosmos or Astro and stuff like that, and we want to make something that is a little bit unique, so that's why we chose Pictor.
Yeah, no, it's a good name, nice and short, memorable, easy to spell. Yeah, it's got all that. And it's something to do with radio astronomy as well, so that's
yeah, exactly, bonus. Absolutely.
Good. Well, I'd like to thank you both very much for taking the time to talk to me. I've got a feeling that I'm going to go off and play with this, and I don't know. I think folk will find this interesting. And as we said earlier, if you've got some skills that are relevant and an interest, go in, contribute to this project. It sounds like an excellent project, and I do congratulate both of you on your work on it. So maybe we'll do a follow-up show if there's further questions or there's more that we'd like to discuss. Thank you very much both for your time.
Yeah, that will be very, very interesting. So, yeah, thank you so much, Andrew.
Yeah, it's our pleasure. If listeners want to do a second part, absolutely, why not?
Yeah, great. Okay.
Thank you.
Okay, and thanks to our listeners for tuning in. And of course, if you have an interest in astronomy, radio astronomy, or anything like that, or you do some interesting observations with the Pictor telescope, please do record an HPR show about it and let us all know. Thanks very much for listening. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to Hacker Public Radio at hackerpublicradio.org. We are a community podcast network that releases shows every weekday, Monday through Friday. Today's show, like all our shows, was contributed by an HPR listener like yourself. If you ever thought of recording a podcast, then click on our contribute link to find out how easy it really is. Hacker Public Radio was founded by the Digital Dog Pound and the Infonomicon Computer Club and is part of the Binary Revolution at binrev.com. If you have comments on today's show, please email the host directly, leave a comment on the website, or record a follow-up episode yourself. Unless otherwise stated, today's show is released under a Creative Commons Attribution ShareAlike 3.0 license.